Domi returned in less than 10 minutes, her white hair tinted beige with the fine powdery sand.
Saw something at the far end of the ravine, about a mile away.
Saw what? More mags?
Don't think so. The light is bad, so all I saw was a little flash of metal.
A wag?
Didn't hear anything. All I saw was a flash, only for a second.
Could be people from the settlement, trailing the magistrates.
Could be.
Or it could be nothing at all. Or at least, nothing to do with this.
Could be.
Kane stood up.
Let's leave most of our stuff here. Just bring the essentials. By the time we catch up to Pollard, he'll have called a halt. We'll come back and get it after.
After what?
After whatever happens.
Oh.
Kane reached for his helmet and slid it over his head. Grant handed Bridget her blaster and rose, taking his own helmet from his backpack and putting it on. Looking at the two men, with their features all but concealed behind the red-tinted visors, Bridget repressed a shiver of fear. The gaze she gave them was the same wary look she might cast toward a pair of tigers if she came across them in her living room. Although she owed Kane and Grant her life and had shared many dangers with them, when they were outfitted in full armor, they ceased to be the men she knew. She could sense the change that came over them. They weren't exiles now, nor were they soldiers or even her comrades. Grant and Kane had slipped back into their magistrate personas as easily as other men slipped into dressing gowns. Once again, Bridget had to forcibly remind herself that the two men had spent their entire adult lives as killers, superbly trained and conditioned enforcers, not only carrying the legal license to deal death, but the spiritual sanction as well.
Everybody got their comm channel set?
Bridget and Domi flipped open the covers of their transcom units, little palm-sized radio phones, and made sure the frequencies were in tune with the helmet comm links.
Set.
Yep.
Bridget shouldered the flat case containing basic survival stores.
We'll move out slow and easy. There's no need to hurry. If you hurry, you're likely to get careless. And if you get careless, you're likely to make noise.
It's not probable, but Pollard may have posted a couple of sentries to watch their back trail if he thinks they're being followed.
Kane turned toward the shadowed, stony maze.
Let's get it done.
The four people walked in a single file, with about 6 feet separating each of them. No one spoke. Full darkness had come swiftly to the canyon, flowing like streams of ink down the walls and oozing out of the mouths of the side channels. Stars gleamed, cold and white against the vast indigo tapestry of the sky. Grant and Kane's image enhancers brought into sharp relief everything around them. They saw small rocks that had been overturned by the passage of many feet and dim scuff marks in the dust. They were faint, but they were sufficient to mark a trail. Kane and Grant followed them, instinctively placing their feet so as to raise a minimum of dust and not dislodge loose stones. The trail led across the rock-strewed gorge floor, winding and bending in a succession of narrow kinks. Grant, for all of his size, moved through the darkened defile as sure-footed as a cat. Kane saw little reason to increase his pace. Whatever caused the commotion was far ahead of them.
What the hell was that?
Kane shook his head, indicating the matter was of little importance, and continued to stride forward. At every bend, Kane's sixth sense, his point man sense, went on high alert for an ambush, but the path twisted on with no one and nothing to bar their way. Even though the mags had a long start, their prisoners would slow them, and Kane saw no reason to take chances with hurrying. Although he hadn't discounted Domi's report of seeing a flash of metal, he didn't devote much thought to it. His prey lay ahead, not behind. Still, the notion of being trapped in a squeeze play in the confines of the gorge didn't exactly help him enjoy the evening's walk. He told himself Pollard wasn't intelligent or foolhardy enough to divide his forces. However, he felt a grudging admiration for Pollard's choice of routes. The average magistrate, assuming any were dispatched by Baron Snakefish, would be completely bewildered by what little trail was left by Pollard and his men. If the mags didn't know exactly who or what they were tracking, they would have given up the hunt at sunset. The canyon finally opened into a field of upthrust stones. Nerves tingling, eyes narrowed, Kane came to a complete stop. He then gestured behind him, signaling his three companions to halt. The dark boulders stood like lonely sentinels, guarding only desolation. The dozen rocks were all of similar sizes and shapes, approximately 8 feet tall, with the facing sides quarried flat. They were arranged in two rows, with an aisle of about 10 feet between them. Other than trying to scale the steep, downsloping walls of the gorge, a traveler would have no choice but to traverse the aisle, as if walking a mineral gauntlet. Kane knew it wasn't a natural rock formation. Someone had gone to a lot of time and effort to place the megaliths in such a fashion. The setup was obvious. As he scrutinized the stones, he saw the flat faces were covered by crude carvings, serpentine whorls, and squiggles.
Baptiste, what do you make of those?
As she squinted toward them, a cloud whipped past the moon, and its lambent glow shone on the standing stones and their inscriptions.
They are obviously artificially arranged.
I figured that out for myself. What I want to know is why they're there at all.
All I can sell is speculation.
I'll buy some if that's all you've got.
We know a snake cult practiced in this region. This could be a holy place where ceremonies or meetings were held.
Pollard and his party came this way, so I guess we can too.
We're being followed!
Grant and Kane pivoted almost simultaneously on their heels, peering into the murk behind them. They saw no sign of Domi.
Where the hell are you?
Heard noises. I hung back for a wreck.
Get your ass back up here.
But I'm onto something.
Now! Baptiste, did you hear anything behind you?
Not a thing. I didn't even notice she dropped back.
Domi emerged with a ghostly grace from the gloom. She stared defiantly at Kane and Grant.
Definitely somebody behind us. They know how to move fast and quiet, and they're wearing some kind of metal on their clothes.
How do you know that?
Heard it scrape against a rock a couple of times. I figured there's more than one tracking us. You believe me, right?
Right. How far behind are they?
Can't be sure. Like I said, they're moving fast.
Take a guess.
Maybe 30 minutes, maybe less.
Kane swung around toward the field of stones.
Let's get across and find a place to lay up for a bit. Maybe we can find out who it is.
What about Pollard and his prisoners? Why did they come this way instead of retracing their steps?
To throw off trackers. The ground is harder here and won't hold prints.
What I meant is if Pollard doesn't make camp and decides to cross the desert, we could lose him while we're laying low.
Even if he crosses tonight, we know where he's heading. Let's move out. Stay as quiet as you can. Don't even breathe hard.
Carefully, Kane stepped forward. Kane began walking again, feeling the flush of shame heating his face and neck. The warmth quickly faded, replaced by the chill of mounting tension. His point man's sense insistently rang as he approached the double row of upright boulders. The ophidian coilings chipped into the rock faces were more visible the closer he came, and he repressed a shudder of loathing. He had always prided himself on being free of phobias, but with a touch of chagrin, he realized he had developed a fear of reptiles over the past year. It wasn't an irrational fear, but derived from unpleasant experiences. First, there was his encounter with Lord Strongbow and his mutagenically altered Imperial Dragoons with their scale-ringed, snakish eyes. That was bad enough, but his fear reached its culmination during his nightmarish battle with Kukul Khan atop a ziggurat in South America. When Kane reached the first pair of standing stones, he tensed his wrist and the sin-eater sprang into his hand. He glanced behind him and saw not only Grant, with his weapon filling his hand, but Bridget and Domi fisting their blasters as well. Kane continued striding forward, doing his best not to break into a sprint. He sensed other presences, felt malignant eyes watching him from the shadows where his night sight could not reach. The feeling ate at his nerve ends like acid. Passing between the boulders, he saw that three of them bore bullet pocks, all near the base. He knew they were recent, probably less than an hour old. He rocked to a sudden halt, his throat tightening in an almost painful spasm. Out of small burrows in the bases of the megalithic stones reared the wedge-shaped heads of diamondback rattlers. They slid out and looped themselves into sinuous, twisting coils, their tongues flickering out to taste the human scent. In a panic-stricken fraction of a second, Kane realized that although the snakes were large, with heads the size of his fist, they weren't monstrous in size like the muti they'd seen earlier. Unless, of course, these were fresh hatchlings, and the enormous mothers slithered somewhere nearby. Despite the threat, Kane didn't press the trigger stud.
Don't shoot unless you have to. Keep moving.
Gritting his teeth so tightly his jaw muscles ached, Kane concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other, his eyes darting back and forth beneath his visor. He tried to keep to the exact center of the aisle between the standing stones so as to maintain a distance of at least 4 feet between him and the snakes. He was aware, however, the distance wasn't a safe one, since all the snakes looked to be a minimum of 6 feet long, and he knew they could strike more than half of their length. One of the snakes struck at his left leg. It required all of his willpower not to jump aside. Such an action would bring him within reach of the snakes on his right. Cold sweat beaded on his forehead beneath the lining of his helmet. It was a frightful trap, and he wondered briefly both about the diabolical brain that had concocted it and how he could put a 9mm hollow point round through it. It seemed obvious to Kane that someone had to tend the Diamondbacks, bring them food, pamper them in order to keep them in the vicinity. If he hadn't already witnessed how the Amazonian Indians deified their mutated anaconda, he wouldn't have believed humans would serve a serpent. Kane continued walking.
Oh, I love this. I really get a big fucking kick out of this.
Kane closed his mind to Grant's profane mantra, focusing only on reaching the end of the ghastly gauntlet. He wasn't particularly worried about himself or Grant, since the fangs of even the biggest Diamondback wouldn't penetrate their armor. But Domi and Bridget weren't so protected. Although they wore high-topped jump boots of thick leather and trousers of tough whipcord, he wasn't sure if the material of either article was dense enough to deflect penetration of needle-tipped teeth. If the women were as uncertain of it as he was, they gave no sign. They didn't utter a sound, not so much as an outcry of disgust, so he ceased to worry about them. Even if one of them were bitten, Bridget's medical kit contained ampoules of antivenin. By the time Kane passed between the final pair of megaliths, his heart trip-hammered as if he had just sprinted 2 miles flat out. Sweat flowed down his body beneath his Kevlar undersheathing. He kept walking, not turning his head to check the progress of his companions until he was well past the last of the standing stones. Within seconds, Grant joined him, then Bridget, her jade eyes startlingly bright in a face drained of all color. She was almost as pale as Domi. All three people trembled slightly from the adrenaline coursing through their bloodstreams. They waited for Domi to complete the gauntlet, watching as she cautiously strode along the aisle, expression composed and detached. Her composure broke when a snake on her right, its temper evidently more aroused than its brethren, squirmed away from the base of the megalith to block her path. Grant lunged forward, the boar of his sin-eater centering on the serpent, but Kane restrained him with an arm.
Wait!
Silver suddenly gleamed in Domi's fist. Domi took a tentative step forward. The Diamondback's flat-snouted, wedge-shaped head struck at her leg. Not crying out, Domi's convulsive movement to evade it brought her within reach of a serpent on the other side. She shifted like lightning to avoid the flash of its fangs. Then all the snakes swayed and struck at her feet, ankles, calves, and knees, whatever portion of her limbs chanced to be nearest to them. Domi couldn't leap over them or pass between the stones to safety. She could only whirl and wheel and twist her body to avoid the strokes, and each time she moved to dodge one Diamondback, she put herself in range of another. She shifted position constantly, even though she could move only a short space in any direction, and the venom-filled fangs menaced her with every motion. Only someone with the reflexes of the wilderness-born could have lived more than 10 seconds in the aisle. Domi became a blur of bewildering motion. The heads missed her by hair's breadths, and she matched her coordination and eye against the speed of the coiled, darting demons. The long blade in her hand flickered almost as swiftly as the forked tongues of the rattlers. It sliced the air in flat circular arcs, then cleanly sheared through scales, muscles, and bone. It seemed to Grant, Bridget, and Kane the snakes struck with a rhythm, as if they worked in tandem. If so, Domi and her slashing knife attuned themselves to that rhythm. Even in the uncertain light, they saw the hard, stitched-on smile creasing Domi's lips as if she enjoyed herself immensely. As she skipped lightly among the serpents, her long knife flashed in quick strokes. Amazingly, the Diamondbacks began to retreat toward their nests at the bases of the megalithic stones. Domi slid gracefully between 2 more of the Diamondbacks. She performed a pivoting pirouette, and the pair of blunt heads collided. The snakes, in terror, attacked each other, their bodies intertwining and knotting, fangs sinking repeatedly into scaled coils. Domi's spin brought her to the end of the aisle, and she half fell into Grant's arms. Her fierce eyes glittered like drops of fresh blood. The expression on her scarlet-spattered face was beatific, satiated, as if she had just undergone a sexual experience.
Are you all right? Did any of them bite you?
Pushing herself away from his armored chest, Domi swayed dizzily for a few seconds. She turned her head.
Nah, not fast enough to bite me.
She brandished her knife, the blade carmined and sticky.
Bit them instead. Taught them big-time lesson.
Yeah. Once word gets out, all the snakes in the world will think twice about provoking you again.
Let's be on our way.
They did so, Domi affecting a jaunty, hip-swinging swagger. Whatever had wrought the change in the girl's personality over the past few weeks, it had turned her from a spirited but reliable ally into a wild card, and Kane wasn't comfortable with the transformation. Judging by the frown tugging at the corners of Bridget's lips, neither was she. They strode into a narrow pass framed by perpendicular ramparts of stone. They weren't very high, less than 20 feet. The cleft ran fairly straight, and at the far end, moonlight shimmered on the desert sand. The sky was clear and speckled with stars. Before they were halfway through, they came across the body of a man lying face down in the pebble-strewed dirt. When Kane rolled the body over, the cause of death was immediately evident. The man's face and limbs were swollen to half again their normal size and tinged a purplish blue from the venom injected into him through the 6 puncture marks on his legs. Kneeling beside the corpse, Kane eyed his coarse homespun clothing.
An outlander. One of Pollard's prisoners. When they came through the snakes, he was one of the unlucky ones.
That's the reason for the shots we heard. The mags panicked.
Can't blame them much.
Whoever's the warder of the snakes can't be too far away, since he or she or they have to feed and water them. They probably heard the shots.
Maybe. But if they saw the mags, they probably dug a hole and pulled the dirt in after them.
I hope you're right. This is about the best place for an ambush I ever did see.
Rocks suddenly fell into the pass, tumbling from both sides. It wasn't an avalanche, it was a barrage. Kane barely dodged a square block of stone. Swinging his head up, he caught only a glimpse of wild, scabby creatures with hair hanging in knotted masses to their waists. Then a rock twice the size of his head smashed into the crown of his helmet, sending him into darkness. Father Jaramillo stood at the makeshift altar during the evening prayer service of the Ophidian Way.
And blessed are the rattle and the skin of the great worms.
Jaramillo's flock of 30 twisted on the benches made of flat stones, mouths agape in fearful wonder. Blaster fire was rarely heard over the past couple of decades. Some of the younger members had never even seen a blaster, much less heard one fire.
Unbelievers cross the sepulchre of the sacred snakes, infidels!
His congregation gaped at him incredulously.
No way!
Way! Very much way! Infidels with blasters dragging their ship across our holy ground! They violated sacred place erected by Brother Moat himself!
The men of Jaramillo's clan were short and stocky, with spindly limbs. Thick hair grew low over their broad brows and hung in matted braids about their shoulders and backs. For the most part, they wore breechcloths and moccasins. The women were very slight of build, almost fragile, except their bare arms and legs rippled with wire-taut muscles. Their pinched faces held the furtive, cunning expressions of she-foxes. Physically, Jaramillo was no different than the other men in the gathering. However, he wore the minister's mantle, a long apron-like garment decorated with swirling designs worked in red thread to represent the movements of sidewinders. Because he wore the mantle, Jaramillo knew the spirit of the scale and rattle would demand blood and souls and retribution. Generations ago, according to legend, the Ophidian Way had been founded when Snakefish was a thriving populous ville. Every home in the township displayed the holy snake emblem. Brother Moat, the founder of the order, had reputedly carved the symbols in the gauntlet of standing stones, ever after called the sepulchre of the sacred snakes. Like Moat, Jaramillo was its guardian, the caretaker of the serpents. As a rite of passage, before they could father children, all male congregation members were required to walk the sepulchre. If they were bitten and recovered, then it was believed they had been cleansed of their sins. If they died, they were viewed as righteous sacrifices to the sacred snakes. True, there weren't as many sacred snakes as there had been during Brother Moat's day, certainly very few of the gigantic ones, but there were still enough for the congregation to maintain its fundamentalist faith. The Diamondbacks living in the sepulcher ate better and frequently more often than Jaramillo's clan. Field mice, rats, and vermin of all sorts were trapped and fed to the snakes, not just to keep them in the area, but in the hopes that they would grow as large as their huge antecedents. That hope was pretty much a vain one. Only in the past 10 years had a rattler been hatched that actually attained a size comparable to the holy worms of yesteryear. Jaramillo had named it Gideon and conditioned his people to pay it homage, to love it unquestioningly, even when it killed 3 of them in a 4-year period. It was a damnable choice for Jaramillo to make, since for the holy serpents to be served properly, they required people to attend to their needs. Sometimes, if the hunting was poor, Gideon would slither into their village. The clansmen and women dropped to their knees and passively awaited their fate as the great snake selected a meal, as if his family of worshippers were nothing but a pack of rats. But by strict interpretation of the Ophidian Way canon, Gideon's venom slew only the ungodly, even though one of his victims had been a 2-year-old child. Jaramillo convinced himself and his followers the sacrifices were part of a very old tradition. He knew the history of the Ophidian Way, as set down in Brother Mote's texts, did not derive so much from the Christian fundamentalist snake-handling sects of rural pre-dark America as from ancient times, from the days of Montezuma the Sorcerer King and his sacred serpent, a Biberon, a monster rattlesnake. The great divine serpent was worshipped in the black shadows of Aztec pyramids long before America was discovered. The priests raised huge snakes, believing them all to be messengers of the gods. According to the folklore of his people, the Indians of the Taos Pueblo in New Mexico sheltered one of Montezuma's divine serpents. The tale also maintained that on special feast days, infants were fed to the gigantic rattlesnake. Whether or not such a story was true, Brother Mote had promoted the same belief in sacred snakes when he created the Ophidian Way more than a century before. It was only a continuation of Native American religion, and he borrowed heavily from the mythography. However, not only had the Ophidian Way lost many of its holy serpents since Mote's time, but the faith had lost almost all of its popularity as well. Acolytes of the Ophidian Way were considered criminals, so the congregation didn't dare venture too near Port Morning Light, and certainly not even within sight of the Ville of Snakefish itself. Jaramillo was deeply offended that the Ville bore the name of the birthplace of his religion, but its baron saw no hypocrisy in dispatching black-armored heretics to hunt down adherents to the very order that the original Ville had venerated. Some of the younger people occasionally wondered what it was like in the big-walled Ville, but Jaramillo insisted the world beyond their canyons and desert was filled with soul-shredding dangers. Their land was the only true land, and now blasphemers invaded it. Even the nearby ruins of the old pre-dark town were forbidden to the clan. Seeing the houses, as overgrown and dilapidated as they were, could give them ideas of another way of life. Jaramillo knew that mere words, no matter how passionately they were spoken, weren't sufficient to motivate the people to attack armed men, especially if they were the armored forcers in service to Baron Snakefish. Although it was not a holy day, Jaramillo took the medicine brazier from beneath the makeshift altar and prepared it for the ceremony of commitment. The brazier was the huge, bleached-out skull of Azarel, one of the sacred snakes deified by Brother Mote during his ministry and elevated to the status of a holy relic. Despite its age, the skull still retained the pair of long, hollow fangs curving down from the upper jaw. From a wooden box beneath the altar, Jaramillo took fistfuls of a dried, brownish-green herb and crammed them into the empty sockets that once held Azarel's venom sacs. He touched a torch to the herbs until they began to smolder. A pungent, sickeningly sweet odor arose. Grayish-white smoke boiled from the tips of the hollow fangs.
Will the men come forward and place thy lips on the sacred skull? Inhale his breath!
In pairs, they did so. The vapors produced by the burning herbs were astringent and powerful. The herbal concoction had many names, but it was best known as Cannabis lupus, the werewolf weed. It was a rare narcotic, hard to find even in the hindmost regions of the Outlands. Composed of a mutated form of marijuana and mixed with peyote and talache, the weed stimulated the hindbrain, sometimes known as the reptile brain. It triggered an atavistic regression, allowing those who inhaled the fumes to wallow in ruthless bestiality. Its influence made men fearless and bloodthirsty, but while in its brutal grip, they could just as easily turn on their comrades as on an enemy. When it was his turn, Jaramillo knelt before the acrid smoke. He instantly felt the first deadly thrill of its effects touch him. He felt the hunger in him, the bloodlust, the stirring of the beast that lay so close beneath his skin. The torchlight danced on the upturned faces of his followers, their eyes glowing with the beautiful madness. The congregation lifted their stone-headed axes, clubs, chert knives, and spears fashioned from lightweight wood. The women would not accompany them, since the order could not afford to lose any of them. They were needed for breeding. Besides, in a struggle against infidels, they had no sense of proportion or restraint, even though a number of them could throw rocks with deadly accuracy.
If they had defiled the sepulcher, you know what we must do!
Righteous sacrifice!
Kane wondered absently for a few seconds why the constellations wheeled so wildly in the heavens. It required another few seconds for the whirling, vertiginous feeling to settle down into an insistent throbbing, reminding him of a hangover he had suffered a year or so ago, just prior to his escape from Cobaltville. Blinking hard to dispel the amoeba-shaped floaters swimming across his vision, Kane's nightsight showed him monochromatic, shaggy figures bounding from the top of one wall to the other, showing discolored and gapped teeth. They heaved rocks over their heads and hurled them down. They were all fairly small in stature, with slitted coal chip eyes and leathery sun-browned skin that gave them the look of Amerindians.
No blasters! No blasters!
Struggling back to his feet, Kane began a shambling run toward the far end of the pass. The rocky ramparts were like the jaws of a trap, inexorably closing on the four people. He warded off stones falling from above, but a couple of heavy rocks struck him on his polycarbonate-encased shoulders. Kane worried about Bridget taking a blow to the skull, and he momentarily considered dropping back to protect her with his armored body, but to do so would jam up Grant and Domi. Kane reached the mouth of the cleft and sprinted into open, sand-covered terrain. His surge of relief was instantly replaced by a jolt of fear. Digging in his heels, he rucked to such a sudden stop that Grant nearly slammed into him. Spread out in a semicircle, a horde of small, shaggy figures threw fist-sized rocks at the four outlanders.
How dare you drag your shit across holy ground!
More of the figures moved in, emerging from the shadows, wielding stone and wood clubs. Their motions were animalistic, partially bent over, eyes jerking back and forth furtively. Though small in stature, their limbs rippled with twisted, knotted sinew and stringy muscle tissue. One of them thrust at Kane with a crude spear. Kane slapped it aside with his copperhead, then delivered a snap kick to the man's groin. Another savage came too close to Bridget. As the two shaggy men staggered away, both bent double, stones began flying again. Grant and Kane put Domi and Bridget between them, forming a protective bulwark. Rocks bounced from their black exoskeletons without doing serious harm. Kane could not help but allot the half-naked wild men a certain amount of credit for their cunning. By dumping stones on them in the narrow pass, he and his companions were forced out into the open, literally into the arms of the larger body. The barrage of stones ceased. Small people glided around them, hefting spears and bludgeons and rope-muscled arms. A quick head count showed Kane at least 15 of them, perhaps more skulking out in the shadows. Even though the primitive weapons couldn't penetrate his or Grant's armor, they would be overwhelmed by sheer force of numbers, and the stone knives would seek weak points in their polycarbonate sheathings. A man wearing a short, ragged mantle over his gaunt frame started forward, his eyes blazing from beneath a wild tangle of hair. He bounded, leaped, and gesticulated as if he were suffering a spastic fit. The wild-eyed and wild-haired savages slowly advanced.
Blades!
Grant drew his combat knife from his boot sheath. Kane did likewise. Domi hadn't resheathed hers, and Bridget unsheathed her own knife, a Fairbairn Sykes commando dagger. A knot of savages suddenly made a concerted rush, trying to bowl them over through numbers and momentum. Grant lashed out with the barrel of his sin-eater, the heavy frame crashing against the skull. The savage's hands clasped to the bleeding split in his scalp and bone. Domi wielded her knife like a butcher's cleaver, chopping a thrusting spear haft in two. Then driving the pommel into the wielder's face. Her lips creased in a smile and her eyes blazed. She moved like a wraith, constantly shifting position and stabbing and slashing as she did so. A crude stone axe swung out of a mass of men toward Bridget's lower belly. She dodged it and kicked the savage's kneecap loose with the metal-reinforced toe of her boot. He hopped away, plucking at his maimed leg. Kane swung his razor-edged blade in a flat, fast arc. The savages engaged in a reluctant, stubborn retreat. The wounded backed away. 5 near-naked bodies lay on the sand in widening pools of blood. The survivors didn't retreat far, just out of reach of the deadly knives in the fists of the 4 people. They glared through matted screens of hair.
We've got no choice now. We were lucky that time, but now they know what to expect. We'll have to use our blasters or they'll chill us all.
I know. Let's open up on full auto, cut a path, and run like hell. Baptiste, Domi, you cover our backs.
Domi nodded, finger curling around the trigger of her combat master. The fire of combat still burned brightly in her eyes.
So much for catching Pollard by surprise.
If nothing else, maybe we can make it back to the redoubt before Pollard and lay a trap for him there. But we have to stay alive long enough to do that.
Just give the word.
Kane's gloved finger hovered over the trigger stun of his Sin Eater. The savages began another slow advance, moving in a measured tread, spreading out around them in a wide circle. Their swart dark faces were masks of implacable ferocity, their eyes glittering with homicidal rage. Kane did not enjoy killing outlanders. He had done too much of it as a magistrate. But now that blood was spilled, there was no hope of talking their way out of the situation. For whatever reason, these people had devoted their lives to this hard land. All they knew was that it belonged to them, and they'd keep it at the price of their own blood. Shooting to wound was not an option. The Sin Eater's rounds impacted against flesh at 335 pounds of pressure per square inch. Even a bullet striking a limb resulted in heart-stopping hydrostatic shock. So in order to escape the savages, they would probably have to slaughter the majority of them.
Most of those people look like they're related to an Indian tribe, interbred with indigenous Hispanics.
I don't give a shit if they're interbred with Mormons. Look at their eyes. They're fused out, flying high on something.
On three.
Set.
Kane eyed the distance between his Sin Eater and the nearest group of savages.
One.
Kane caught only a brief, almost subliminal streak of movement flashing overhead. The arrow almost went completely through his torso. Another shaft sped through the air. It struck a man in the clavicle. The third arrow struck into a savage's upper thigh, the barbed point protruding from the other side of his leg. The little man writhed, clutching convulsively at the shaft. Kane knew if he removed the arrow, the femoral artery would open up like a faucet and he would bleed to death in a matter of minutes. The shaggy-haired horde began a disorganized, clumsy retreat. Kane did not dare turn his head to locate the source of the deadly arrows, but he could tell by the quality of the workmanship, from the steel tips to the fletching, they weren't of Native American origin. The wood of the shaft caught highlights from the moon and stars, giving them the impression of being lacquered. The man wearing the ragged mantle turned to his people. He shook his fists, obviously exhorting them to do their duty. The savages hesitated in their retreat, ready to obey. Another arrow flashed overhead, then punched through the right eye socket of the man in the mantle. The back of his head was broken open, the arrow's point holding a wad of brain matter ahead of it. The entire horde turned and raced away across the hard-packed sand. Kane figured the skull-impaled man had been a chief or someone of importance, and his sudden death broke the nerve of his followers. Swiftly, he and his companions turned their eyes, seeking and then fastening on the ornately armored figure poised atop the rocky ramparts behind them. It stood in a bizarre, almost hallucinatory contrast to the barren surroundings. Each segment of the armor was made from wafers of metal held together by small, delicate chains and overlaid with a dark brown lacquer. The overlapping plates were trimmed in scarlet and gold. Between flaring shoulder epaulets, a war helmet fanned out with twin sweeps of curving metal like dark wings seen edge-on in flight. The helmet bore a sickle moon on top, positioned between a slender pair of foot-long antlers of softly gleaming alloy. The face guard, wrought of a semi-transparent material, presented an inhuman visage of a snarling tiger. Obsidian eyes glittered through the slitted eye holes. A quiver of the long arrows dangled from the figure's shoulder. 2 slightly curved long swords in black scabbards swung back from each hip, thrust through a broad blue sash. Even as the 4 people gazed in astonishment, the masked figure raised a very long laminated bow, holding the string by an ivory thumb grip. Surprisingly delicate hands and slim arms extended the bow forward, bringing it down from above the sickle moon mounted on the foreport of the helmet and to eye level in one smooth motion. The arrow was released. They did not take their eyes off the figure above and behind them.
What the fuck is that?
Samurai!
Domi centered the sights of her combat master on the figure.
Don't know what samurai is, but I don't like the sound of it.
Instantly, with almost supernatural swiftness, an arrow was plucked from the quiver, knocked into the bowstring, and drawn. The barbed steel point was pointing directly at the Outlander girl. No one spoke. The four Outlanders and the samurai stared at one another in a frozen tableau. Brigid's lips moved slightly, and her brow creased in concentration as she dredged deep into her eidetic memory. Then she took a tentative half-step forward, making a very deliberate show of snugging her Ivor Johnson pistol back into its waistband slide holster.
Anato yuku ne mutaka?
What are you saying, Baptiste?
I think I'm asking him to put down his weapon if we do the same.
The antlers mounted on the helmet inclined toward her a fraction of an inch.
Let's do it.
Kane hesitated, glanced toward Grant, who, after a frowning second of thought, nodded in agreement. Both men carefully pushed their sin-eaters back into their forearm holsters. They resheathed their combat knives as well. Only Domi kept her blaster trained on the armored horned figure above them.
Leather at Domi.
Don't trust anybody whose face I can't see.
We don't expect you to, but you can show some basic respect. This samurai warrior saved us after all.
Didn't need saving.
Leather it.
Domi shoved the combat master into her shoulder rig, but she kept her knife unsheathed, dangling at the end of her right arm. The samurai swiftly and expertly relaxed the tension on the bowstring, replaced the long arrow in the quiver, and with a surprising grace descended the rocky slope in a series of running leaps.
What language was that you used, Baptiste?
Japanese. I'm not very conversant with it. I've only read phonetic translations of it in the database, not spoken it.
Kane was surprised she knew even imperfect Japanese, although he shouldn't have been. Brigid spoke Russian, a smattering of Chinese, German, and even Lakota, the tongue of the Sioux Indians.
What's a samurai anyway?
They were the knights of medieval Japan. They began as the military elite, then became the political elite. The samurai were warriors of legendary skill.
This one looks more like a legendary gaudy lad.
The samurai either didn't understand or chose to ignore the Outland's euphemism for male prostitute. The helmeted figure approached them, right hand resting on the cylindrical hilt of a sword. With each step forward, the samurai's stature seemed to diminish. Even with the antlers topping the helmet, Kane doubted the warrior was much taller than Domi. Grant took the lead and began to remove his helmet. Kane took Grant's lead. The samurai followed suit, thumbing open two toggles on the bottom rim of the helmet and tugging it off. Then Kane saw why the samurai's figure was so slight, the hands so small. Glossy black hair tumbled down over the flaring shoulder epaulets. A small, beautifully shaped mouth stretched in a wan smile, above which was a smoothly curving bone structure under sculptured flesh. The woman's complexion was a very pale gold, with roses and milk for an accent. The almond-shaped eyes shone as fierce and proud as those of a young eagle. Grant felt a sudden, disconcerting clenching in his chest. He didn't know why, except he was looking at one of the most beautiful and exotic women he had ever seen in his life. Her dark eyes swept over them in an appraising stare, and her lips curved in a smile.
You can meet the most interesting people in the desert.
Brigid bowed.
Domo arigato. Thank you.
Your pronunciation is very good.
I've never had the opportunity to speak your tongue before. We appreciate what you did for us.
I merely extended you a warrior's courtesy. I could see you didn't wish to do battle with the primitives and were reluctant to employ your firearms.
You've been following us.
No. I was following a much larger group. One that murdered the people of Port Morninglight and took others prisoner. At first, I thought you were part of them, stragglers perhaps. Then I realized you were also tracking them and wishing to be quiet about it.
May I ask the name of our rescuer?
I am Shizuka, first lieutenant to Captain Kyomasa. We are Tigers of Heaven in service to our high daimyo, Lord Takaun.
Scraps of memory, more like impressions, ghosted through the minds of Brigid, Grant, and Kane. The Tigers of Heaven touched faint chords of recognition of an armored security force of samurai who traveled the spaceways. The recollection slipped through the fingers of their minds like smoke. All of them knew the impressions weren't memories of events that had actually happened, at least not in their reality. They were the traces of their experiences on parallel worlds, when their minds possessed the bodies of their alternate universe selves, their doppelgangers. The three of them had no clear recollections of those mirror realities any longer. Even Bridget, with her eidetic memory, could only consciously recall disconnected fragments. Shizuka's dark eyes flitted from Grant to Kane to Bridget.
Is there something wrong?
You bet your ass something's wrong! Who sent you to follow us?
My captain. When stealth and tracking skills are required, I am always chosen.
You need to practice your skills. I heard you from a mile away.
Domi.
Where did you come from? You working for a baron?
I regret your confusion, but I have questions of my own. It is one reason I went to the effort of saving you from the Eta, the handlers of offal.
We could have taken him. Didn't need help from you.
Domi!
Hey, Sodesu. Yes, I understand.
Shizuka bowed slightly, only a half bow. And she did it in such a way that even Domi knew it was a deliberate insult.
I should not have interfered. You alone could have saved your companions with the ferocity of your words.
Domi's lips writhed over her teeth, and she lunged forward, her knife whipping up. The flat blade blocked Domi's knife, then returned to the scabbard. Shizuka had not moved from her bowing posture. Although her face remained expressionless, she winked conspiratorially at Domi. Domi suddenly thrust for Shizuka's lower belly. Shizuka stepped sideways in a sliding dance motion, and Domi's knife missed its target. Instantly, Shizuka heeled around, leading with the blade, holding her sword in a two-handed grip. Kane and Grant started to rush forward to intervene.
Stay out of this! I won't kill her, but I'll put my mark on her!
I promise not to harm the child. She is brave, but she needs a lesson in manners.
Look who's talking, bitch!
She sprang to the attack, her knife weaving a web of steel in the air between her and the Japanese woman. Domi held her blade point upward, as did all experienced knife fighters. But she might as well not have. She couldn't penetrate Shizuka's guard. She tried a reverse slash, the flat of the blade lying along her forearm. But the samurai beat it effortlessly aside. Bridget, Kane, and Grant knew Shizuka was treating Domi to an object lesson in the art of the sword. Kane had to admit it was beautiful. Never had he seen such a style, certainly not in the kind of swordplay Quail had demonstrated against him a month or so ago. Shizuka could have carved up the one-eyed cutlass master like a turkey. It quickly became evident that Domi, despite her words, intended to kill her opponent. She rushed at Shizuka, striking wildly. Domi stabbed and thrust for the woman's armpit and her upper thighs, seeking to sever the major arteries there. Her eyes glittered like blood-drenched rubies. Domi plunged forward, knife darting low for a hamstring cut. Shizuka's sword deflected Domi's blade, held it, and wrenched it away in a blindingly fast corkscrew motion. Domi's knife flew from her hand. For an instant, she stared at Shizuka, then cut her eyes to her knife. Her expression twisted in disbelief, in furious astonishment. A single long-legged bound put Grant between the samurai and the albino. His big gloved hand closed completely around Domi's right wrist.
Stand down. Stand down, Domi, or I swear to God I'll take your blaster away and hog-tie you with the holster.
Her crimson eyes burned into his with a defiant glare. He met it unblinkingly. Then, by degrees, the fierce heat of her fury guttered out, and some of the tension went out of her posture.
Let me go!
Grant released her, towering over her for a moment to make sure she wouldn't try to use her blaster again. All she did was grimace and massage her wrist.
I'm sorry, Shizuka. It's been a long day.
The woman nodded graciously and slid her sword back into the scabbard.
And full of hardship. She is young and undisciplined, but I admire her courage.
And I admire your restraint. But the fact is, she did make a couple of interesting points, regardless of her poor manners. Where did you come from? Surely not Japan.
It is unlikely that you have heard of my home. And if you have, then my daimyo's advisors should be severely punished. Permit me to communicate with my captain. If he wishes for you to know more, then I must receive permission from him.
Reaching into her sash, she produced a black square of pressed plastic, not much larger than the palm of her hand. It was a smaller version of the transcoms used by the Cerberus personnel.
What's the range on that thing?
She used a thumb to flip open the cover.
Depending on the weather and the terrain, about 3 miles.
That's quite a distance for a com that small.
Among the many traditions of my people is a devotion to a miniaturization.
She walked away a few paces, lifting the comm to her ear. While she was so occupied, Grant plucked Domi's knife from the desert floor and presented it to her, pommel first. Without a word, the girl took it and thrust it firmly into the leather sheath at the small of her back.
You were way out of line. She's an expert with her sword. You're damn lucky all she did was disarm you, not decapitate you.
Domi acted as if she hadn't heard. Wheeling, she just leaned against an outcrop of flint, arms folded over her chest. Grant turned his back to her, and Kane moved beside him.
I don't know what's going on with her, but she's making trouble we don't need. Straighten her out.
How do you expect me to do that, Kane?
Somebody better. Obviously, Shizuka isn't the only samurai in the vicinity. Until we know how many Tigers of Heaven are around and why, we have to be at our diplomatic best. And that includes Domi.
Then you tell her about diplomacy. I'm not her damn daddy or her husband. You two were the ones who insisted she come on this op, not me.
Kane and Brigid arched their eyebrows at him at the same time. Before either one could speak, Shizuka strode back, returning the comm to her sash.
Captain Kiyomasa will arrive shortly with the rest of the force.
It appears we have the same goal, catching up to those who attacked Port Morninglight. Our reasons may differ, though.
What's Port Morninglight to you?
Captain Kiyomasa wishes to meet you before any information about us is given out.
Understandable.
Do you know who the attackers of Port Morninglight are?
Sorry. We wish to meet with Captain Kiyomasa before any more information about us is given out.
You have a sharp wit, and I like that. Since I've provided you with my name and a lesson in swordsmanship, the least you can do is tell me who you are.
Sure. This is Kane, Brigid, and I'm Grant. Your dueling partner over there is Domi.
Shizuka bowed to each one of them in turn, including Domi, who made a studied show of ignoring her.
Your name is an honorable one with historical significance. As I recall, Shizuka Gozen was a heroine of feudal Japan.
I had not expected to meet any Westerner so educated about my people, especially out here. I was named in honor of Shizuka Gozen, a member of a great samurai family during the reign of Yoritomo, the first shogun. During the 11th century, she was in love with Yoritomo's brother and rival for the throne, Yoshitsune. He became a fugitive, and Shizuka was forced into Yoritomo's harem. One evening, when she was ordered to entertain him, she defiantly sang a song in praise of his brother. The shogun was so enraged that when Shizuka gave birth to a male child, he had the baby murdered before her eyes.
And she became something of a martyr to women's rights in male-dominated Japan.
Indeed, that I carry her name is a matter of pride.
She turned toward Grant, examining the red magistrate's badge affixed to the molded left pectoral of his breastplate.
Speaking of a pride, what significance does that peculiar emblem hold?
None now. It used to have a bit.
Kane repressed a smile. Between the two of them, Grant still had the most difficulty accepting his criminal status.
Was it the symbol of some lord you served?
In a way.
Why do you continue to wear it? Is it to spite your former master?
It's more in the way of protective coloration.
So you are like Ronin, masterless samurai, wanderers, mercenaries.
We're not mercs. We have no master or lord to serve, but that doesn't make us hired killers.
I have offended you. Please forgive my poor manners. It is apparent you follow the code of Bushido.
All of them turned toward the pass, and an apparition stepped from its mouth. His elaborate armor featured overlapping plates of silver and black, and his breastplate was engraved with the sign of the mantis. Over this was a long surcoat of blue silk, accented by white and red embroidery. His broad helmet bore long, outcurving horns, and the lowered face guard held the aspect of a demon. A flat, mirror-bright blade glinted in his right hand. The four samurai who followed him out of the cleft did not bear naked swords, but all of them cradled long blasters in their arms.
Arisaka Type 38 carbines. World War II vintage. I wonder where they found them.
Kane wasn't surprised by Grant's immediate identification of the rifles. Not only was the man a superb marksman, but he was also something of a weapons historian. Kane was more concerned with the way the short barrels of each rifle swung toward him and his companions. The Tigers of Heaven not only looked as if they knew how to use the three-century-old blasters, but also like they wanted to use them very badly. The Sin Eaters sprang into Grant's and Kane's hands. Although they didn't aim their blasters, the Tigers of Heaven swiftly spread out so as not to present easy targets. Shizuka strode to the man with the demonic face guard. The man then motioned peremptorily to the samurai behind him. Without hesitation, they lowered the Arasaka carbines. Backstepping carefully, Shizuka reached a point equidistant between the Tigers and the four Outlanders. She bowed toward the demon-faced samurai.
May I introduce Captain Kyomasa?
The man scabbarded his sword with the same sharp, quick movement they had seen Shizuka display. He lifted his visor on tiny hinges and stared at them impassively. His features were full-fleshed, with a sharp, hooked nose set below heavy eyebrows. His eyes were very thin slits with no emotion in them. Only a penetrating intelligence gave them any spark. A thin mustache drooped at the corners of his unsmiling slash of a mouth. There were faint scars on his face, and Kane was sure there were more under his armor.
Captain Kyomasa, please meet Grant, Kane, Brigid, and Domi.
Kyomasa surveyed them one by one, as if silently gauging their capacity and skills for violence. Kane did his best to meet that judgmental stare without blinking. The armored man did not speak, yet Kane felt the impact of his presence. Finally, when Kane's eyes were on the verge of watering, Kyomasa stopped the visual examination.
Huh.
He bowed his head toward them. The tigers behind him almost immediately assumed parade rest positions, resting the stocks of their rifles on the ground, holding them by the barrels. Brigid returned the man's bow, and after a moment's hesitation, Grant and Kane followed suit, holstering their blasters. Domi only stared with thinly veiled suspicion.
My lieutenant has informed me we apparently share the same goal, to avenge the slaughter of Port Morninglight. That is good. There is nothing like spilling the blood of a mutual enemy to make new friends.
We are not so much interested in avenging the murders as discovering the reason behind them and why prisoners were taken.
Such actions are not common here?
Not exactly. There are gangs of marauders and bands of savages, but it's unusual for the type of men whom we follow to do something like this.
Ah, then you know who they are.
Yes.
Perhaps we should agree to an exchange of information. A question for a question, an answer for an answer.
Kyomasa re-examined the four people standing before him.
I will tell our tale, and inasmuch as my lieutenant saved you from the savages, you may discharge the debt by telling me the identities of the raiders.
Kane glanced questioningly at Brigid, then toward Grant. He was reticent by nature and had become more so since his exile. A casual word spoken to the wrong person in the wrong place could spell death for everyone in Cerberus, and perhaps even the destruction of the installation itself.
There doesn't seem to be any reason to hold out on them. We're just as curious about them as they are about us. It's the diplomatic thing to do.
Kyomasa suddenly dropped to his knees and swiftly arranged his legs in a lotus position. Shizuka did so as well. The samurai motioned with his hand.
Sit, Kane-san.
Brigid, Kane, and Grant lowered themselves to the ground.
Tigers of Heaven, you may come forward. Meet Jozure, Ibichi, Kuroda, and Odo. Hai! And now, you will hear the tale of our people.